Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Friend Wrap. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, today joined by Dr. John Endres. Today's news stories, we're going to be talking a little bit about South Africa's future energy mix and some setbacks for the environmental movement when it comes to policy. We're also going to be talking a little bit about some outrageous abuse of state power, particularly relating to the army. And we're going to be talking about the reality of the informal economy, about shakedowns, gangs, and extortion. If we have time, we might do a little bit about internal ANC politics. Let's go into our first story. This is a report from News 24, which is talking about the new integrated resource plan, which is a plan of how South Africa is going to manage its energy supply for the next couple of years. I think 2050 is the sort of time scope when this thing looks at it. So, you know, quite far in the future. The resource plan is based off of what is described in the piece as a controversial plan to slash from 2023, which will slash planned installation of solar and wind power. But when you actually get into the details, it really doesn't seem nearly as severe as that in the framing. So the framing was SA goes for gas or nuclear, but when you actually read the details of the story, it doesn't seem really like that. According to this, by 2039, coal will be about 27% of South Africa's energy mix. Wind will be about 24%, solar 18%, gas 11%, and nuclear will be about 5%. So that's significant increases for wind and for solar from what they currently are, a significant decrease for coal, a massive increase for gas, and about a doubling of our nuclear capacity. Now, what's interesting about this is overall energy mix. This is not like there's no plan to shut down coal power stations. There's simply plan to build things that are not coal or not nuclear. So the idea here is that there's going to be a massive construction of wind and solar farms. Apparently, Eskom has been instructed to construct a clean coal demonstration plant by 2030 that uses cheaper and more efficient technologies to remove sulfur dioxide from exhaust gases. There's talk of massively expanding the amount of gas to power we use, which it's unclear how that's going to work because South Africa's main source of gas that it's importing right now is from Mozambique, and the gas fields there look like they're going to run out soon. And while potentially South Africa has a significant amount of gas, we've not really begun development of it due to significant policy stuff. When it comes to nuclear power, there's plans to increase our usage of nuclear power to restart the Pebble Bed modular reactor, which was a South African project that was shelved in 2010. China has recently done a version of that reactor, which they've made commercially viable. So South Africa looks like it wants to start its own version of that. And the overall idea here is that there will be 105,000 new megawatts of electricity generation by 2039, which will represent investments of 2.2 trillion rand. Now, John, I'm a little bit skeptical always of these very far out long-term government projects because the day-to-day of politics so often gets involved and, you know, suddenly there's not money for this or the policy changes on this or you get a new government and they completely reverse on this. But overall, this seems sort of in the right direction. I don't know. What's your take on this?
Let me just unmute myself. Yes. So I think what got us quite excited about this is the fact that it is economically so important, right? So we're all about economic growth and we want the economy to grow. And if there isn't electricity, then the economy is not going to grow. And so what this plan says is that they want to add another 105,000 megawatts of generating capacity to South Africa's total capacity by 2039. And currently we're sitting at about 50 total installed capacity. Not all of it is working, but we've got about 50 and we're going to add another 105. And that's exactly the kind of thinking that's needed, right? So if we want economic growth to happen and we want maybe even electricity prices to come down, and we want supply to be stabilized, and we want smelters, and we want beneficiation, and we want industry. We want all of those things to happen in South Africa. We're going to need electricity. So in that sense, this is good news that we're seeing the government speaking about expanding the amount of electricity that we can generate in the country. Then another thing that is good about it, I think, is that it does recognize the importance of nuclear, even though it's at a very small scale as a share of the total energy mix. But we had this very interesting pebble bed modular reactor system being developed in South Africa, as you mentioned, up to 2010 or thereabouts. I think it got canned because of cost reasons. And they said, no, we spent 12 billion rands on this, and this is such a waste of money. Let's stop. Just want to remind viewers and listeners.
Rookie that, numbers.
Yes, because I just went and looked up the cost of Medupi and Kusile, those two coal-powered stations, which ended up costing 234 billion and 233 billion, respectively. So the entire cost of the pebble bed modular reactor research project was about 2.5% of what we've spent on those two coal-fired power stations. So in my view, we should have kept going. And maybe by now we would have had a functioning nuclear system on a modular basis. That would have been pretty cool. But nonetheless, at least we're going back to it. And I think also the rest of the world is heading that way. So there's a great interest in all parts of the world in these small modular reactors. And if we can get some of that good stuff for us, that'll be very good news. Then we also had the natural gas in the mix, which is also positive. That's certainly a much cleaner burning fuel than coal is. South Africa probably has got quite large reserves off the West Coast, which we are doing our best not to exploit by putting in place policies and laws that make it very risky and very expensive for the international companies that have the expertise to do such things to actually invest the billions of dollars needed to start exploiting those gas fields. So that might be a bit of a wishful thinking behind that. I'm not sure if we're going to see the gas being developed, but we could. You know, it's there for the taking. And with a better investment environment, a better policy environment, I think there's every opportunity to use that resource. And then we've got wind and solar in the mix, which I think have their place. But I think it should be done judiciously and not at a pace too rapid that makes the grid less stable and drives up the cost of electricity too fast, as Germany and the UK have experienced, for example. Nick?
Yes. So I think another major kind of stumbling block on here, and you can see it in the reporting on this story, that Eskom had plans to build a 3,000 megawatt gas to power station in Richards Bay, and due to a lack of public participation in the environmental approval process, it got blocked by the Supreme Court of Appeal. Mm. The current sort of framework around environmental objections and regulations about community input and that sort of stuff, obviously you need some of that stuff, you know, so that you can avoid companies just completely destroying the environment around and people not having a say and stuff that goes up around where they are. But if you don't reform those, you're going to run in South Africa, I think, into a problem that a lot of countries in the West have run into. I'm thinking of, for example, famously California in the United States has difficulty building anything because there are so many options and abilities of various groups and special interest groups and such to object to any kind of development that you just see it ground to a halt. And I suspect that everything, and it's not just going to be gas or nuclear that gets pushed back on this front. You know, solar farms, wind farms, they can also take up a lot of space. They can obstruct people's views. They can be noisy. They can do this or that. And you find people who are very willing to object to those as well. So that's going to be a major problem if we actually want to see some of these electricity gains realized, is that we're going to see, you know, those regulations are going to have to be re-examined, because otherwise every single one of these projects, except for ones that are like in the middle of absolutely nowhere, are going to get caught up in huge amounts of red tape and end up in court battles that go on forever that balloon the costs and delay the projects. And that's another sort of thing that I think South Africans haven't even begun to sort of grapple with in a real way.
Yeah. But at least, at least we're thinking about it, and I hope that we can get it right. And if we focus on the importance of economic growth as a country, then I think we're going to reach the conclusion that these projects need to get off the ground. It needs to happen. Otherwise, we won't get the economic growth.
Exactly, exactly. Kind of related story is there's been pressure from activists across the world on reserve banks across the world, but including the South African Reserve Bank, that they must loosen up their monetary policy so that they can more readily bankroll the green transition. And I think wisely the Deputy Reserve Bank Governor has pushed back on that. The Deputy Reserve Bank Governor in South Africa says that should South African central banks take on the challenge of climate change? The answer is yes, but with limited and clearly defined parameters. Proposals for central banks to finance the fight against climate change by weakening their commitment to low inflation and setting rates low to make climate financing cheaper, misguided, and sure to fail in their objective. That is a big no. She said, speaking at the University School of the London School of Economics. Many African countries, the financial sector is underdeveloped, which makes the cost of finance high for climate-related investment projects. With limited fiscal space, public finance alone cannot shoulder the climate financing burden. In this context, calls for central banks to promote climate-related financing are justified, but should they, or even can they? So, a bit softer than what I would have said, perhaps, but John, there's this kind of idea out there that... I think among very radical environmentalists that you can kind of almost cast the economy aside, that, you know, the environmental problems caused by climate change or by overdevelopment or whatever are so great that we need to sort of almost, you know, throw growth aside. I mean, we've seen the most radical versions of this, sort of like the degrowth movement, who think that GDP growth should stop. Now, I don't think that group is particularly influential, but the point remains that... there's this sort of idea that a weak economy is good for the economy, for the environment in some way. And I think that's just not true. When you have dysfunctional states and dysfunctional economies, they're not able to invest in environmental protection. And in fact, you know, you get people dumping toxic stuff into rivers. You get states that aren't able to enforce, you know, climate regulations, that kind of stuff. These things are not mutually exclusive. You have to grow your economy in order to be able to afford environmental protection.
Mm. Yeah, I think there's even, I forget what the name of it is, but there's somebody's law that says that once you exceed a certain GDP per capita amount in dollars, that's when the environment starts getting better. And I think, you know, once you don't have to struggle for sheer survival, then you can start thinking about making your surroundings nicer. And you want to reach that point, right? You want to get to the point where you're rich enough to clean up your surroundings, to take care of the environment. And I think South Africa in many ways is not there yet. You know, we've still got a lot of catching up to do. We're still too poor. But we'd love to get to the point where we can do that. And I thought it was very good of this Reserve Bank person. Was it the Deputy Governor? I forget what her title was. Deputy Governor, yeah. To make this point and say, you know, we've got a job to do, which is to ensure that we've got sound money in South Africa to keep inflation low. And this is not something we should soften up in the interest of an ideological pursuit, like the Green Agenda, for example. So I think that was a very good response from her. Quite right.
Okay, let's move on to our next story. Completely different topic, but one that sort of, you know, can only make you laugh because otherwise you'll cry. The headline is, Army truck drives 1,200 kilometers to remove tree stump from Major General's yard. A truck with a crane was recently purchased by the South African Defense Force and was doing various logistics tasks around the country. And it was on the way, it was in Oudtshoorn on the way to do some work. When it was given the instruction that it needed to head back to Pretoria urgently because it was a great emergency that required this piece of equipment immediately. And it turned out, according to reporting from Report, that this was because a major general needed a tree stump removed from his wealthy neighborhood. He instructed the subordinate to make a plan to use one of the unit's brand new trucks to remove the load. These 10-ton trucks were recently acquired by the SANDF and were being used in combat training centers around the country. To make it worse is that the truck was actually scheduled within 2 weeks to return to Pretoria, at which point it presumably could have been used for this urgent task. But no, it was so urgent, tree removal so urgent, the driver had to drive halfway across the country. John, you know, unfortunately, this is the only kind of story we seem to see about the SANDF these days, is either equipment is broken, soldiers not being paid, or state resources just being abused like this.
Yeah, so one of the things I find so illustrative about the story is the degree of disconnect from reality that it reflects. It also reflects an unbelievable degree of economic illiteracy for this general not to have realized, well, let me do a cost comparison. What is the cost of sending a truck from Oudtshoorn to Pretoria to remove two tree stumps, including a driver, plus diesel, fuel, AA rates? You know, it's going to cost this many thousand rands. Or I just hire a local service. You know, there's already people with trucks in Pretoria who can come and do this for us. So from this general's perspective, I'm sure he thought this was for free. So he says, you know, we've got this free truck. I don't actually care where it is, but, you know, we must use free resources first because it doesn't cost any money. So by all means, let's order the guy here with his truck and to remove my tree stump. Unbelievable. Also staying in Waterkloof, I see, which is a very swanky part of Pretoria. So very nice for the generals. But yeah, not great for defense.
The house he's staying in is actually being rented in the area by the military, is actually paying for it. I suspect that he was trying to show off to his neighbors about how much of a big shot he was. I think that's the real reason that this happened.
Maybe. Look how powerful I am. I can command a truck.
Yes, as we all know, being able to command heavy equipment around is the pinnacle of, of power. But yeah, no, just, you know, this is what happens when you see the sort of total melting down of professionalism in the public service, is that you get public servants essentially acting kind of almost like warlords, just sort of using state resources as though it's their own. And, you know, not only is it a waste, but it sort of undermines morale. I mean, it doesn't say anything in the reporting, I don't think, about the driver swapping out. So presumably he had just driven to Oudtshoorn and then had to drive back in the same shift, in which case he was going to be irritated and he's probably going to be sleep deprived. So maybe this could have caused a horrible car accident. I mean, this is just.
Yeah. And I mean, also, Nick, like this morning in our staff meeting, we were talking about, you know, South Africa's military preparedness, which is woeful. I mean, it's been covered many times on the show before. But like if there's a maritime problem out at sea, like we haven't really got resources to do anything about it. If there's a problem at land, we really also don't have resources to do anything about it. And, you know, just question of priorities, allocation of resources, seriousness of focusing on the mission at hand is completely lacking. It's not a good story.
Yeah. And I've made this point before, but geopolitics can change very quickly. Right now, South Africa doesn't have any major threats on our borders, thank goodness. But maybe there's a coup in Zimbabwe and some rogue government comes to power. Maybe Mozambique collapses into a civil war and suddenly that starts spilling over into South Africa. There's all sorts of contingencies which can develop quite quickly, which you need a military to be able to deal with. And right now, South Africa has no such thing, which is why we are endangered by this.
And also, you know, you as a historian will know that wealthy, defenseless nations often become prey, right? If you're in your neighborhood, you're the wealthiest place and you can't defend yourself, somebody's going to notice and take advantage of it. So, yeah, good luck, South Africa.
If you want a more modern example of that sort of thing, look at the way the governments in places like Qatar, the UAE, or the Saudi behave. They're very paranoid, and they're always seeking foreign protection and foreign defensive pacts precisely because they're militarily weak but very rich, which means they sort of are constantly looking for a patron. And it's not a good place to be in, and it usually isn't good for the citizens of those countries too, because they tend to become sort of paranoid and unfree. Okay, let's move on to our last story. Or I don't know how we're doing for time. Let's see, second last story maybe. This is a story from Ground Up. Ground Up are people who do, you know, kind of different reporting from most reporting in the country. And they cover stories which usually wouldn't make it into the mainstream news, but I think are really interesting and important for kind of getting a sense of what life is like out there in South Africa. So this is from Brown's Farm in Philippi, where a number of spaza shops since Wednesday have had to close after gangs have demanded protection money. Three Somali shopkeepers were shot on Wednesday, one of them fatally, and a spaza shop was set alight in the early hours of Friday. A Somali shopkeeper who spoke to Ground Up and named himself as Abdul said the decision to close his shop was made after the shooting on Wednesday. He said, quote, "We used to pay one group every month, but now we are forced to pay two different groups every week. These people take all our profits. We are working for them. If these people keep coming, we may never open again." It's not only foreigners being targeted. Small business owners, hair salons, vegetable stalls, meat sellers are also being targeted by the same gangs. Some have shut down permanently because they can't afford the protection money. A woman who runs a vegetable store said, "If you don't have money, your life is in danger. I stopped selling because I was working just to pay them. Now my children are suffering because I was the only breadwinner." A resident from the local area who refused to be named, showing how terrified everyone in this area is of being attacked by the gangs, said she struggled to buy food and other essentials since the shop closed. "We depend on these shops because they are cheaper and close to where we live. If this continues, we are going to suffer." And it goes without saying that most reports of extortion are not even, people don't even bother to report them to the police. John, I recently got a mail from one of our colleagues about, it had this attached, this report on the informal economy from Standard Bank. And you hear quite a lot of talking about the informal economy, right? About all the interesting things doing. Gigi Alcock has written really interesting stuff about it. And there's lots of, you know, interesting and notable and amazing economic activity that goes on in the informal economy. But there are very severe limits when you have a failure of state capacity to enforce the basic rules. And I think here is a great example of this, is that without the police to protect people, you have people who are just working for a living, who are providing services, who are providing goods to their local communities, who are being ruined by gangs. What's your take on this?
Yeah, so there's sort of lots of different angles you can see in the story. One of them, I think, is that we observed a few shows back that typically people say that poverty causes crime, but maybe the even more important relationship is that crime causes poverty. And this is where you see it, right? So you've got people who are not wealthy, but they're, you know, operating a business to get by. And then get shut down by criminals. You know, imagine not just getting shaken down by one gang, but getting shaken down by two gangs. That's going to make it very difficult for you to make a profit, to survive, to prosper, to grow your business, to hire staff. So crime does suppress economic activity. It slows down economic growth, and it ruins people's lives. That's effectively what it does. And another aspect that came out here, I thought, was that some of these shopkeepers are did not enter South Africa legally. And so they're afraid to go to the police for that reason, because they'll say, you know, I'm going to get jailed because I haven't got papers. And of course, that is another consequence of this state of insufficient law and order and insufficient rule of law, that you've got millions of people in this position where they have been in South Africa for many, many years. They didn't regularize their affairs or haven't had the possibility to do so. And now they're pretty much stuck, even though they're producing and performing a useful role in the communities where they are based, like the spaza shop owners are. You know, there was one resident who was interviewed in the story who said that if the spaza shops remain closed, it's going to make her life a lot harder, because they're nearby, they're open for long hours, she can get what she needs from them. But if they're not open, then
provide credit as well for people who buy from them who don't have money at the time.
Exactly. And so I think this sort of in a microcosm encapsulates many of the problems that we have as a country. Our economy can't grow because there's too much crime. Lots of people are in a situation where they can't really move forwards or backwards because their legal situation is dubious, and there's no plan for what to do about that. You know, so some parties will say deport them all. I don't think that's feasible. But there's also not really a plan for regularizing that situation and saying, well, you know, let's figure out how to get your papers and how to make you a tax-paying citizen of South Africa, which is, I think, what should be done. So a very tricky situation. And there's another angle, which is a bit more abstract, which is what we see here in the micro scale is also kind of what's happening in the macro scale. So when South Africa's government imposes more and more regulations, more and more financial burdens on companies, effectively, it's the government playing the role of the shakedown artist, the extorter, and it suppresses economic activity. It was another thing we commented on in our staff meeting this morning, in several of the new laws being proposed at the moment, that they propose to hold directors of companies liable for quite a long list of transgressions against the specific law, resulting in consequences ranging up to jail time of 10 years. And that is within the new mining law, there are provisions like that. In the Climate Change Act, there are provisions like that. And all of this is not good for getting the economy to grow, which is really what needs to happen. So yeah, the Spaza Shop story, you know, seems very local, very specific, but it reflects a lot of the problems that we've got in the country in regards to economic growth.
Yeah, and it's a story that you know, if you looked into each and every township across the country, you'd find it repeated a million times over. Which is the other thing. This is millions of people's lives actually being affected by stories exactly like this. Yeah. Okay, let's very briefly talk about our last topic. We're definitely going to come back to this one because it's not going anywhere. But Juanita Hunter has written an opinion piece, suggesting that by ruling himself out of the ANC presidency trip, Patrice Motsepe is actually beginning to build a narrative that might see him catapulted into leadership of the ANC. In June, Adrian Basson, the editor-in-chief of News 24, wrote an opinion piece about titled "We Don't Need a Messiah, But Maybe We Need a Motsepe," about Patrice Motsepe possibly leading the ANC. And this has been kind of some speculation out there that despite Patrice Motsepe publicly not acknowledging any interest in running for ANC leader, that he's going to be the savior of the ANC who rides in and becomes what Cyril Ramaphosa promised he would be, which is this kind of billionaire manager savior who rights the party and turns it around. So, John, obviously there'll be more opportunities to discuss this topic, but for now, do you think, firstly, there's any chance this might happen? And secondly, would Patrice Motsepe actually, quote unquote, save the ANC?
Yeah, so I think Juanita Hunter may be onto something here, because I think this coyness gets rewarded in the ANC. I think the ANC as a party doesn't really like people putting themselves forward for high office. Rather, you must resist and be urged to, you know, sacrifice yourself.
The branches must demand it.
The branches must demand it. There we go. Exactly. And the more you resist, the better your chances get. Plus also, I guess that the ANC might, by that point, by the time of its elective conference, be so riven with divisions and factions that they'll look for somebody who's not really aligned with any faction, but can be the great unifier, the great uniter. And maybe that is Patrice Motsepe. I don't know what his internal view of the matter is. You know, so his words say that he doesn't want the job, but Ramaphosa said the same thing. And look where he is now. So maybe we will see a President Motsepe.
Yeah. He's probably, of all the potential candidates I've heard suggested, probably the best choice the ANC has. But I'm still skeptical that, someone who, if, let's put it this way, he's either an insider, in which case he'll fail because the ANC clearly has no one inside who can turn things around, or he's an outsider, in which case the ANC won't accept him, even if he, has the ability to actually change things. But no.
But maybe he's the insider outsider. Maybe he's, sufficiently outside and sufficiently inside to make it work.
Yeah, I mean, look, if I understand internal politics of some of the other parties much better than I do the ANC, it's not a strong suit of mine. So I'm completely open that I'm very wrong on this. But this is kind of my feeling at the moment, is that there's just too many people want the top job, And as as an organization begins to fall apart, infighting tends to get worse, not better.
And that makes it less appealing as well, right? So if you're Patrice Motsepe looking at the ANC today, you'll say, well, maybe it's a kind of turnaround project. It'd be interesting to try. But maybe 2 years
from now, I'll be president of the country.
Yeah. Yeah. And but 2 years from now, you might say, well, we're actually beyond that point and there's no salvaging the thing. So no.
Yeah, exactly.
But can't really tell now.
I do suspect, though, that the next ANC electoral conference will probably produce another breakaway party of some kind. I don't know what that party will be. It depends on who wins. But, you know, in that environment, it might be smarter for someone like him to go and support or join that new breakaway. Or lead it rather than try and save the sinking ship. Anyway, interesting things abound. Thank you very much for listening. We hope you found the show interesting, and we will see you tomorrow on The Daily Friend Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day. The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.